Well, turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 to 21. My throat's a little off, so I'm not going to be able to yell at you like I usually do. 2 Samuel chapter 11, and this should be familiar, I've been reading it the last two messages. 2 Samuel chapter 11, beginning in verse 1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanliness. Then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, saying, "I am pregnant." So David sent his word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite," and Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the palace with all of his master's servants and did not go down to his house. When David was told Uriah did not go home, he asked him, "Haven't you come from a distance? Why didn't you go home?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will do no such thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants. He did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. Joab sent David a full account of the battle. He instructed the messenger, "When you have finished giving the king this account of the battle, the king's anger may flare up, and he may ask you, 'Why did you get so close to the city to fight? Didn't you know they would shoot arrows from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal-Sheth? Didn't a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebez? Why did you get so close to the wall?' If he asks you this, then say to him, 'Also, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead.'" Well, as always, it's good to be here to open up the Word of God to you tonight. We're going to continue our study of this historic event between David and Bathsheba. If you've been coming regularly on Sunday evenings, you'll know that this is the third message on this text, and it may or may not be the last. There might be a fourth, I'm not too sure at this point. Now, you will remember in the last two messages, we've covered seven truths. And all seven of the truths we've looked at in the past are very relevant to our text tonight, which is going to be the topic of adultery. So by way of review, the truths that we've already covered in the last two messages, and there's seven of them, are as follows. We talked about, first of all, the danger of the sin of idleness. That was the first one. The second was the need to be cognizant of the slippery slope of sin. The third was the insatiableness of sin. The fourth was the speed at which grievous sin can fall upon even the most faithful of believers. The fifth was the power of the desire that we have to conceal our sin. The sixth was the importance of guarding one another from sin. And the seventh was the terrible long-lasting consequences of sin. Those are the seven truths we covered in the last two messages. Now tonight, as I already mentioned, we're going to be moving into the topic of adultery. Now, adultery and murder are obviously two of the primary themes in the text. Both are devastating. Both are devastating sins, but they're devastating for different reasons. Murder is devastating, obviously, because it takes life, but adultery is devastating because it destroys life. The life of the offended spouse, without question, but as is often the case, also the life of the offender as well. Now, of course, our primary goal in studying adultery tonight is to know what we can do to guard ourselves from it from occurring. Obviously, we want to prevent sin in any case rather than having to deal with it after it's occurred. But before doing that, and we're going to get practical later on in the message, but before doing that, we need to look at some theological principles surrounding this topic of adultery. Now, biblically speaking, we need to understand that there are two types of adultery. Two types of adultery. There is the sin of adultery, and then there's the actual act of adultery. And it's important that we understand the differences because it's possible for a person to commit the sin of adultery without actually having committed the act of adultery. Now, this fact, this difference between the two, might have been a little bit obscured in King David's day, but it was clarified by Jesus Christ himself in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 27 and 28, Jesus said this, "You have heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So you see, Jesus highlights the fact that a person can be guilty of the sin of adultery without having actually committed the act of adultery. And what that means, when we apply it to our text, is that David was guilty of the sin of adultery the moment he lusted after Bathsheba from the roof of his palace, even though the act had yet to take place. Now, had King David stopped at the lusting stage and never sent for Bathsheba, he would have been guilty of the sin of adultery, but he would not have been guilty of the act of adultery. By way of another example, a more modern-day example, a wife comes home early, and she finds her husband sitting at the computer, and he's looking at pornography. Well, based on what I've just said, I would suggest to you that the husband is guilty of the sin of adultery, but he's not guilty of the act of adultery. Now, why is that important? Why is that distinction important? Well, it's important for a number of reasons. First, it highlights how seriously God takes the sin of lust. He views it as adultery. Sins that take place in our minds must be taken as seriously as the acts themselves. The world's perception that it's okay to look but not touch is a lie and not biblically based. Jesus provides this strong exhortation, I guess is what you'd call it, in the verses following the Matthew 27:28 text. He says this, that if your right eye, and again, this is in the context of lust, that if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Now, he's not saying that we should literally gouge out our eyes, otherwise we'd all be blind, but he's using hyperbole. I think that's the English term for it. He's basically using an exaggeration for effect. He wants us to realize how important we need to take sins of the mind. We also must not forget, as we talked about last time, about the slippery slope of sin. The act of adultery, the actual act of adultery, is always, always preceded by lust or the sin of adultery in the heart. Now, it's also important to understand this distinction between the sin of adultery and the act of adultery, because there are different ramifications. There are different ramifications. For example, under the Old Testament moral and civil law, the act of adultery was punishable by death. It was punishable by stoning. But that pertained only to the act of adultery. So going back to our text with David and Bathsheba, had David lusted after Bathsheba but not followed through with it, with the act itself, there would have been no grounds to stone him under the Old Testament law. To put it more simply, lust is punishable by God as a sin, but was not punishable by man under the Old Testament law. And the same is true today, but with different ramifications. Going back to our Matthew chapter 5 text, in verse 31, Jesus says this, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce." So that's what the Pharisees were teaching. And it did have some foundation in the Old Testament. "But I tell you," Jesus says, "that anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness or the act of adultery, causes her to become an adulteress. And anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery." So what is Jesus telling us here about divorce? Well, Jesus is saying that the act of adultery, is biblical grounds for divorce. That's how serious adultery is. It provides biblical grounds for divorce. And we know that God hates divorce. But in the case of adultery, it's permitted. Now let's take that teaching and apply it to our example of the wife who comes home and catches her husband looking at pornography. In that case, does she have biblical grounds to divorce her husband, knowing full well he has committed the sin of adultery in his heart? Well, the answer to that is no. No, she doesn't have grounds for divorce. What he has done is not good. It's grievous. He has committed the sin of adultery in his heart, and it's something that needs to be taken seriously and needs to be addressed. But it does not provide biblical grounds for divorce, because although the sin has been committed, the act has not. Now that hopefully makes good sense. If we are honest with ourselves, truly honest with ourselves, probably every single person in this room has committed the sin of adultery in the lustful sense, in the heart. Well, if that was the same, treated as the same as the act itself, then in the Old Testament we'd all be dead, and in the New Testament we'd all be divorced. So we need to make this distinction between the sin of adultery and the act of adultery. And I want you to keep that in the back of your minds as we go along. So the sin of adultery can occur without the act, but the act cannot occur without the sin, if that makes sense. It also goes without saying, I think, that in the event we realize we have committed the sin of adultery in the heart, we should not have that mindset of, oh well, the sin has been committed, I might as well commit the act as well. Although sin, all sin is grievous, and all sin is deadly if left unchecked, it is also true to say that there is a sliding scale regarding the severity of sin. I would much rather stand before God and be guilty of hate than being guilty of the act of murder. And the same is true of lust and adultery. I'd rather be guilty of the sin of adultery in the heart than the actual act of adultery. As Paul warns us in Romans, there is no such thing as sinning more that more grace may abound. That reasoning is an abuse of grace and is not biblical, and God is not hoodwinked by it. So that's the theology. Now we need to get practical. And in order to do that, we need to deviate a little bit from our text, because the context from David and Bathsheba to today is significantly different. You know, none of us are royalty. None of us live in palaces where we can walk around on the roof and look down on the houses below. And the feminists will get a little upset, but we don't live in a male-dominated society like they did back then. We live in a little bit more of an egalitarian society. So the practical applications are a little bit different. And so I'm not really going to draw in the text for the practical applications. I'm going to draw more from my own personal observations, and I think which is just simply common sense. So how do we avoid the act of adultery? Well, it goes without saying that we obviously need to avoid the sin of adultery in the heart in the first place. And we also must go back to the seven truths that we've looked at already, because those are hugely practical and hugely relevant. But I'm not going to go back and look at those, because we've already done that. I want to look at what else or what other precautions can we take to prevent us from sliding into the act of adultery. Well, the first truth I would bring to your attention is going to seem very counterintuitive given the topic, but I think it is really important. And it's as follows. We need to trust our spouses. We need to trust our spouses. The reason why adultery is so destructive is because of the trust it betrays. That's why it's so devastating. But trust is also that which makes a marriage strong and which makes a marriage special. Over the years, I've known a number of individuals, both believers and unbelievers, who have failed to appreciate just how important this truth is. And it's been evident in their relationships. They've had this unhealthy jealousy, maybe, or suspicion towards their spouse. What's the term I'm looking for? I've lost it anyways. But they've kind of always eyeing their spouse in a suspicious way without any reason or evidence for it. And when that happens, the marriage will never flourish. It will never flourish. I think we need to realize it's a catch-22. It really is a catch-22. To have a healthy, full, loving marriage, you need to kind of lay yourself out there for your spouse and trust them completely. But that, of course, then opens you up to being devastated in the event of adultery. But it needs to be that way. It needs to be that way. By God's grace, I can say I have an awesome marriage. And part of that, I think, other than how wonderful I am, is attributable to the fact, I'm kidding, is attributable to the fact that I trust my wife absolutely. I am not checking her text messages. When I'm working night shifts, I'm not driving by the house to see if there's some random vehicle in the driveway. You know, I didn't download a secret GPS tracker on her phone. I'm not wondering where she is, who she's talking to, you know, are you at the grocery store right now? No, I trust her. And I trust her absolutely, unconditionally, and vice versa. And I think because of that, our marriage has been great. It's been great. And we actually see that with Uriah, don't we? We actually see that a little bit with Uriah in our text. Now notice that when given the opportunity to go home, not only does Uriah not go home and, you know, hang out with his wife, sleep with his wife, but he also didn't go home and check up on her either. He didn't go over there, hide in the bushes and look over the hedgerow to see what she was up to. No, he trusted her absolutely. There's no indication he asked his neighbor, hey, make sure you jot down and let me know if Bathsheba's running around all over town on me or anything like that. No, there's no indication of that whatsoever. He was trusting. He trusted his wife as he was supposed to. Now, he got burned for it. He got burned for it, but he did what he was supposed to. He was faithful. So we need to trust our spouses, not that we're supposed to be blind to obvious indications of adultery, but we need to trust our spouses if we want our marriages to flourish. We need to put ourselves out on the limb, so to speak. Now, the next thing I want to spend some time talking about is the different ways that the act of adultery can come about, I guess. And there's two that I'm going to bring to your attention that I think we see predominantly in our culture. The first is by chance, and I don't think it's generally seen in Christian circles, although it can. And this is the circumstance, and I'll use the example of a man, maybe goes out with some friends, maybe goes out for a friend's bachelor party or a birthday party. This man might be in a good marriage. He might believe strongly in monogamy. He might believe strongly in being faithful to his wife. But he gets out on the town. Maybe his friends are of less noble character. He ends up having too much to drink, and he ends up getting intoxicated. And in his drunken folly and in his lowered inhibitions, as alcohol has a tendency to do, he ends up meeting some girl at the bar and does what he shouldn't be doing. Now, faithful believers don't tend to fall into that type of adultery because they're discerning enough to avoid those circumstances and those types of people in the first place. But that doesn't mean it can't happen. It only takes one error. It only takes one time. I'll share a personal illustration. About 6.5 years ago, I was on a work-related course out of town. And I've actually used this illustration before in a previous message on, I don't even know what the topic was at the time. So I was on a work-related course. It was 6 weeks. We were out of town. And during the course, I thought my testimony was pretty good. But on the last night of the course, we all decided that we were going to go out for supper and maybe have a beer. And after that, I told the guys I'm going back to the hotel. And I got ridiculed. Absolutely ridiculed. And they bullied me into going out with them for a night on the town. I wasn't wise enough to stand on my principles. And what happens is I went out and I got absolutely boiled and destroyed my testimony. Now, thankfully, by God's grace, I didn't get involved with any women that night. But I asked myself, what would have happened had the opportunity arisen while I was in that state? Now, I would like to believe that even under those conditions, Even in my drunken stupidity, I would have had the wherewithal to do the right thing. But I'll tell you something, sober me and drunk me are two different men. And I do not trust the later. I do not trust the later. And therefore, I should have never put myself in that circumstance. Now, thankfully, again, it was just my drunken stupidity that destroyed my testimony, and it wasn't worse than that. But it potentially could have been. Now, again, the danger of that type of circumstance is pretty obvious, right? It's pretty obvious. And again, I don't tend to think that believers tend to fall into that error because they're smarter than I am. What's more dangerous, I think, from a Christian context, is the adulterous relationship that can develop over time. Often affairs begin with what we might consider an innocent friendship. Maybe it's a friendship that begins at work. Maybe a guy and a gal are assigned to the same work project, and because they're on the same work project, they take their coffee breaks together, they take their lunch break together. Obviously, as is normal for human behavior, conversation covers an array of topics. And it might come to light that a number of interests are shared. Maybe interests that aren't shared with their spouses. Maybe there's a common interest in sports or fitness. Maybe they decide to join a sports team together or start working out together or join the running room together or any number of things. And they begin to spend more and more time together as friends. Now, many of these friendships can last a lifetime without becoming adulterous. But in my opinion, and this is just my personal opinion, that doesn't justify their existence. That does not justify their existence. And I say that because, in my opinion, it is impossible to completely remove the natural sexual draw that men and women have towards each other. Let's not forget that often single people meet their future spouse in that same way, that it begins as a friendship. Well, it's also how a married person can fall into an adulterous relationship and therefore must be avoided. It's really not worth the risk. That's really what it comes down to. It's not worth the risk. I have many female friends. Many of the women in this church I would consider as friends. I have female coworkers that I would consider as friends, but I would never hang out one-on-one. It's dangerous. It's just dangerous. You see, I would suggest to you that most people, especially in the Christian community, who have fallen into adultery, they weren't looking for it originally. They didn't go out there looking to get into an adulterous relationship. It was something that happened slowly and matured over time, and then it just kind of happened. And that's why it's so dangerous, so very dangerous, as it can easily sneak up on us. Now, if you're here today and you have a friendship as the one I'm describing, you might be tempted to rebuke me, and you might be tempted to swear up and down that you have never had any adulterous or sexual feelings or personal feelings whatsoever for your friend, that the friendship dates back to when you were in high school together, maybe, and it was a friendship that was there long before you were even married, and has always been completely platonic. Now, in response to that, I would say, I absolutely believe you. I believe you. I believe that that's absolutely true. But the past does not always predict the future. Not always. All it takes is a change in circumstance. Maybe you have a bit of a falling out with your spouse. You go through a rough patch or any number of things. And of equal importance is the fact that you do not know your friend's motives. You might think you do, but you really don't. Your friend might claim to be only interested in you as a friend, but really they're in love with you, and they're just waiting for that opportunity, especially if this friendship is a believer-unbeliever type situation. Finally, perception. Perception is also a factor that, as believers, is something we need to be cognizant of. It's very relevant. The world will take any opportunity to slander us, and we need to be aware of that, even if it's completely unfounded. Completely unfounded. If you and your friend are always going out for lunch together, what do you think your coworkers are thinking? I guarantee you, at least if you're working the same kind of environment that I work in, they're whispering stuff, wondering what's going on. And then the rumors start flying. And I'll use another personal illustration because something similar to that to this happened to me. When I first started working about 10 years ago, there was a woman on my shift who was involved in coaching me a little bit. And we worked on the same shift schedule in the same part of the city. And because we did a pile of calls together, we actually ended up becoming what I would consider pretty good friends. Now, we didn't hang out together outside of work, but when we were at work, we'd go and get a coffee together if it wasn't too busy, and we'd just do a lot of calls together. Well, one day, my boss was talking, I can't remember if it was the two of us together or if it was just me, and he referred to this woman as my work wife. And as soon as he said it, I just cringed. I just cringed, and it dawned on me, I wonder if people think there's something going on here. And because of that, and really everything I've said, but at the time, for me, it was perception, I started to distance myself because of the perception. I don't know if anybody thought anything was going on. I'd like to think my character spoke more than that. But who knows? And quite frankly, it doesn't matter. It's perception. And again, I began to distance myself. Perception, even if completely false, as in my own personal illustration there, it's something we need to be cognizant of. We need to be aware of it in our testimony to the outside world. So in closing, I would remind you that every one of us, nobody is immune to adultery. Nobody. You may think that adultery is something you would never do, but I bet you King David would have said the same thing. I bet you King David would have said the exact same thing. It can happen to anybody, even the most faithful of believers. And this is relevant for married folks and the single folks as well, because the single folks can obviously ruin a marriage just as easily as a married person can. Along that same vein, I remember being told a story about a pastor. I don't know him personally. I didn't read the book. But I was told a story about a pastor who had written a book about sin and temptation. And in the book, this pastor was talked about different sins that he struggled with and how to deal with it. But he was, I would almost say he was stupid enough to say that of all the sins he knew that he would not commit, adultery was one of them. That's what he said. He said, yeah, I struggle with lots of sins, but I will never commit adultery. He wrote that in the book. Well, guess what happened? A couple years after the book's published, he ends up having an affair with the church secretary. And that's because he let his guard down in that one realm, didn't think it was going to be an issue for him, and that's exactly where Satan got him. It's exactly where Satan got him. None of us are immune to this, as is true of any sin. As is true of any sin. But, of course, especially true in this topic of adultery.